Welcome to Dreaming in a Nightmare. This is our chance and yours to meet remarkable people who inspire change in the world of business and entertainment.
I think the budget was around $2 million, and I was like, loaded, like, let's call Denzel, what's he doing? little did I know, that doesn't go anywhere.
Teresa Ikoko grew up in the borough of Hackney in London. She got a degree in psychology and a master's degree in criminology before running drama projects for prisoners.
I was like, oh my gosh, we're changing the world. If we just teach like enough like roadmen how to play six at Boeing, then there will be no more crime. It's like, I was like, I figured it out.
In 2015, her second full-length piece of work for the stage, Girls, won the Alfred Fagan Award for Best New Play. She then co-wrote the groundbreaking feature film, Rocks, which won Best British Independent Film of 2020 and was nominated for 3 BAFTAs. Currently working on 2 adaptations for the BBC, Grime Kids by DJ Target and Nicky May's debut novel, Wahala, she's one of the UK's hottest and most sought-after young screenwriters. Teresa's hosts on Dreaming in a Nightmare today are Jeremiah Emanuel and Kelly Okogu.
Teresa, I'm going to ask you the first question. And this is great because I feel like there'll be a lot of common ground here because we're all Nigerian. So that's great. Yeah. You grew up in Hackney with 8 siblings, which is unbelievable.
Not all 9 of us were in the same house at the same time. At various stages, there were people in and out of the house. But I would watch TV and see things and then be like, oh, I want to do that. And then I'd see something else and then I'd say, I'd want to do that. I was very, I like to say aspirational, but others might say flaky as a child. Like whatever I saw, I wanted to do, even if I didn't, or not necessarily do, but I wanted to experience. So like if I saw, I remember watching the Mighty Ducks and I was really like convinced that I wanted to be a hockey player, an ice hockey player. And then I went to Lee Valley and I hated ice skating. But that was kind of just how I was. Like if I saw something, I wanted to try it. And I think because for me, it was always a matter of doing well in school. My mum wanted me to be a lawyer because Nigerians want lawyers for children. Yeah, I don't think I know kids always say that they had a dream, but I didn't really.
And you also described your upbringing as rich in joy, even though it was sort of in economic circumstances, not necessarily rich in that sense. So can you talk a bit more about that as well?
My sister Tracy, and she had always been like a really great sort of protector, and she was really good at preserving my childhood for me. So whatever circumstances we found ourselves in, there was always like a dance routine or a made up game, or like even if we had to share like a bath, there would be a water fight. If we had to share a bed, there would be feet fight. So how we played feet fight was that if you're in bed and no matter how, as long as you're not dead asleep, anybody could declare a foot fight, and then you just start kicking. So you could be like literally about to doze off and someone would say feet fight, and then you'd be like stomped. And you know, and those were the things that I remember. So there was always, she was really good. And I don't know if she's even did it mindfully or intentionally, but she was just really good at creating space for me to play and to be a child. And I think, yeah, that was really what made my childhood something that I can look back on and be like, yeah, it was nice. It was all right.
Oh, what an amazing sister. We have to shout out Tracy right now.
She doesn't really remember all those things that she did. It wasn't until, so she came out to the premiere of Rocks, which I dedicated to her. And it kind of was a moment where it triggered like a lot of memories for her. And then we just like went into the toilets and had a conversation and cried, because I have just always wanted to say thank you to her. And I don't know what it is about her. I just really think she's an angel. I really think just God just decided, yeah, you're going to get this one. And he gave me her. I don't know why she did what she did. I don't even know if she knows. She doesn't know why. She can't even remember. But whether it be like I needed money or I just, yeah, she was just an angel. I just think she was a gift. And I'm not sure why and how she knew what to do, what she did when she was like 7. But she always knew.
What has been your biggest nightmare in your life or your career? And how did you get through it?
Career-wise, I wouldn't necessarily say a nightmare, but there was definitely challenges, like, in every process. So with Girls, for example, that was my first show, and I did find that the process of putting a production up quite challenging. It was just everything just kept going wrong. The set wouldn't work, some pieces wouldn't work. People had to travel like around the country to try and find the pieces. Then the ceiling of the set wasn't stable, and the builders said, oh, how long do you need it to stay up for? I was like, we don't want to tell you a time, because if it runs long and it falls on people's heads, then that's a disaster. Then during press night, we had a power cut, and I just like sat in the corner and cried. And I think how I kind of have always just dealt with things, like career-wise, because it is an industry that can be quite intense, and it can feel, I think, particularly for black women, where there aren't that many people that you can look to as examples, it can feel like every opportunity is an opportunity for you to fail and then be eliminated. So I think how I've dealt with that is, one, having like a really good network of people around me who can continue to ground me in the bigger picture of life, and also, two, like having various passions and intentions in my work. So it's always about, I hope, something bigger than my quote-unquote success. So if it has done something else, then I don't put so much pressure on whether, you know, we have a power cut in on a press night, and whether the press think it's good or bad. And so I hope that's what's helped me like navigate the sometimes nightmare of this industry.
In regards to what you said earlier about studying law, I can definitely relate, sort of growing up in a Nigerian household. I think for me, I had a crazy situation where I was offered a full scholarship to go to uni to study law. But again, for me, I literally had no interest in it whatsoever. And I had to sort of like figure out if I was literally going to move forward to study it just to have a free ride at university, or if I wanted to follow my passions and what I was really interested in. And I actually ended up declining it and following the passions. And again, everyone's path is different, but for me, in that moment of time in my life, it was like the best decision that I ever made, because all of the opportunities that brought me to where I am today sort of came after making that decision. So again, everyone's path is different, but before you actually got into writing, you went on to study psychology and criminology, and that led you to work on social inclusion projects and community engagement within prisons. What first fascinated you about psychology and crime back then, and how do they inform the way that you work today?
Doing psychology, I think, because that same teacher who asked me why I was applying for law was my psychology teacher, and I actually, no, it was my politics teacher who was good friends with my psychology teacher, so she got her involved in the conversation, and I was really good in psychology, and she just felt like I had a potential gift for it, and she spoke to me about different career paths in psychology, and she knew that I wanted to do something that made tangible change in people's lives. Well, she articulated that back to me. So then I studied psychology based on literally just one conversation with her. And then I felt like I wanted to do clinical psychology, but then I was like, no. So I thought, let me do forensic psychology. So I did an internship in a psychology department in a prison. And I remember, and it was so boring, but one thing that I got to do was upload the results of the prison survey. So every year, or every certain amount of time, prisons do a survey about the population. And one thing I noticed about the prison population was that statistically, a lot of the criminogenic factors that they presented were things that I was familiar with. So, you know, low-income households, single-parent household, first-generation born. I just started to question, like, what was the difference between me and them, and what was the difference between me and some of my friends who hadn't necessarily had the smoothest path in, like, I guess, like, mainstream society. And then I felt like one of the things was maybe education. and the fact that I had been really blessed, like at all stages of my academic life, I had had teachers who believed in me. And sometimes, like, instead of the detention that I should have had, I would have to, I remember, like, in primary school, like, I should have been in detention, but one of my teachers made me do, like, she made me, instead of just sitting and doing nothing, I would have to do Black History lessons with her after school. So I always had those kind of teachers. And I remember, like, in year four, instead of kicking me out and of class for being disruptive, I was bumped up to year five for the lessons that I was disruptive in year four about, because she wondered if I was disruptive because I was bored. And I recognised how fortunate I was to have, it was real just luck or a blessing or whatever you want to call it, that I just had teachers who, instead of pushing me out of mainstream education, they went the extra mile to fold me into it. So I wondered if that was part of the difference. So I started doing, so I left my internship and I asked if I could do some projects in prison education, and I wanted to make education fun and interesting and engaging. And so we just started doing like things like drama and music to teach literacy and expression and to explore societal issues and needs. And that was like, and I was just so naive, and I was like, oh my gosh, we're changing the world. If we just teach like enough like roadmen how to play Zip Zap Boing, then there will be no more crime. It's like, I was like, I figured it out. I've solved it. So I'm going to go and study criminal justice policy, and then I'm going to implement a better education, and then everyone will be included and everything. And I was just really genuinely thought that I had figured something out that nobody else had figured out, and I was gonna like change the world. And then I did my master's in criminal justice and criminology, and I did a module on political ideology, and I realized that everybody knows that. It wasn't a eureka moment. Everybody knows that, but how invested are they? No one cares, to be honest. It's not profitable in any way economically or politically to do the needful. And I just was really dejected, to be honest, and just really just felt kind of hopeless. And then a friend on the course said, well, what about the things that you were doing before? She's like, if you can't change the world, then maybe you can change the world around you. And with every person who you maybe make a positive impact on, they then make a positive impact on two more people, and then four more people, and so on and so forth. So she really restored my kind of conviction. And then I went and did various projects across different prisons in and around London, Kent, and so forth. And I think how that ended up influencing my work is that I met people that I would never have met before. My expectation of humanity is maybe a little bit wider or vaster than it would have been had I not had that experience. So in both the bad and in especially the good, that maybe is reflected in the characters that I write about. I hope that they're not limited by my experience, because they are poured into subconsciously and sometimes very consciously by the thousands and thousands of people that I met while working in prisons. I worked closely with travellers, with foreign nationals, with asylum seekers, with just local Mandem, with people from all sorts of walks of life, multilingual, various faiths. And I worked with imams and with pastors and reverends. And so I just think it gave me like a massive education of the world. And like I always say, like, joy is the most persevering thing that we have as people. And I just really don't underestimate the power of joy. I really don't underestimate the resilience we have, because I've seen it. A little piece of a lot of people make up my work, I think.
I think you picked up something very important when you were mentioning education, the criminal justice system, and that eureka moment that you had. Because again, you've moved forward to go and study criminology for your master's, and then realise that all the people that make policy, the government, all of the important people know the solutions, but there's no action. And even down to education, in the book, it's one of the main areas that I focus on. Even when you were talking about your personal experiences, a lot of schools just care about the league tables and how they look. So even when it came to myself, there would be times in school, they'll call it low-level disruption, or maybe you might not be focused enough. And what a lot of schools in my borough would do is just permanently exclude the young people. Like, they wouldn't even try and figure out a solution, like you rightly said, or figure out how can we work with this young person a bit more. And then from exclusion, the young person will go to a pupil referral unit. And literally everyone that I knew growing up that was excluded, they either ended up dead or in prison. And these like personal relationships that I've had with people, it just always hits me and gets me annoyed that we have these issues. When I was doing all of my activism, I would walk into the same rooms, I would go on panels, I'll be, I don't know, in the mayor's office or in parliament doing something, and all of these conversations are ongoing. But in terms of change, it just never happens. So it was really interesting when you said that. I think in terms of like your studying, I reckon it was very transferable, especially when you went on to do your master's. In terms of the psychology, do you feel there was anything sort of transferable from your degree that you then brought onto your work in the future? So what you do now with film and TV?
I'm naturally quite a nosy person and inquisitive, I prefer to say. I'm EPing on a show at the moment that I'm just like giving notes to about and reading scripts, and one of the executive producers said to me the other day, she's like, Teresa, sometimes you're like a 9-year-old in the room, because I just ask why. Like, I need to know why for everything. Like, I'm like, why did the character say that? I don't think they would have said that. You haven't established a reason why they would have said that. There is no motivation. There's no intention. That is not like a human response. Like, I think I'm so interested in the complexities of human behavior that I need to know exactly why. If I'm reading the character, if I'm seeing a character, sometimes I'll watch something on the screen. I'm like, I'll be 5 minutes in and I'll be like, oh, they're gonna die. And my friend's like, Teresa, like, why are you ruining it? I'm like, yeah, there's no reason why they just showed us him playing football with his son. He's gonna die. They want you to feel a connection. That's why they showed it, especially they're gonna die. So I hope it makes my writing a little bit more, I would like to say, thorough, because I think I do a lot of scrutiny before it gets beyond me, and I hope the people around me as well. Like, I encourage people around me. Like, I'm not precious at all, so I'm like, I love notes, I love questions. So I think maybe that psychology, or maybe I'm just naturally nosy. Anyway, my mum used to say that when I used to say why all the time, she was built because two arms and a tail or something. I can't remember what the answer, but
she, no, I'll say why. She would say Z.
Yeah, that was one as well.
Literally.
And I think it's an African way of storytelling as well. Like, it's quite a sociological way of telling the story. Like, I'm interested in how the world around the characters create the characters and their behaviour, rather than how, which I think is quite Western, like a lot of Western stories are quite individualistic. They're about the whole be all and end all is inside a person. And I think it's a very African sociological way of telling stories, that it's about the society and the community and how they create the person that you then see on screen or on the page. Sometimes when I'm getting notes, I'm just like, I'm African, that's just how we tell stories. Like, I can't explain it, that's just how we tell stories. Like, I need to know how the world around them. And I read something the other day that talks about, you know, people say, oh, if you could go back in time and kill Hitler, would you? And a Western individualistic storytelling would say, yes, kill Hitler, remove the bad guy. Maybe more African sociological stories would say, well, if you kill baby Hitler, sorry, would you kill baby Hitler, not kill Hitler as a grown man, but would you kill baby Hitler? And I think Western individualistic story would say, yes, kill baby Hitler, and then you remove the bad guy. But maybe more African sociological story would say, well, if you kill baby Hitler, then another one would just replace him, because it's not focused on the person, but it's focused on what are the circumstances that created that person, and how did society impact and breed and feed that person. So yes, I think maybe my storytelling is quite sociological, but I also like to credit my African upbringing for that as well.
It was wonderful seeing your inspiration being like Sister Soldier and Mallory Blackman, and I just wanted to make a point on Sister Soldier, because when we were growing up, I have a sister and she loved Midnight. So I wanted to hear what Midnight was her boyfriend, but in a book.
That was my first ever, because I didn't really like boys when I was young. I didn't like boys at all. But that was my first, I would say, experience identifying like as a woman who likes men, because I thought I was a boy for so long. Like, not in like any like deep or complicated way, I just was always with the boys. Like, I liked my brothers more than I liked my sisters, apart from Tracy, who's perfect in every way. I used to like my mum to tell me off about like my legs were being scarred. She was like, you know, you're not gonna be able to wear skirts. So I was like, I don't want to wear a skirt anyway. But when I met Midnight, I was like, maybe I do want my legs to be smooth so he can love me. I loved him so much.
In your film Rock, so the young women on screen in Rocks come up against all kind of obstacles, economic, social, religious, gender, but their friendship and sisterhood shines through. Do the same obstacles exist behind the camera and how do you overcome them?
I think for a film like Rocks, and to be honest, like I just learned this as we were filming, because I had never made a film before. I'd never been involved in any production and I didn't realise how expensive they were. So Rocks is a small budget film. I think it's public information. I think the budget was around $2 million. And I was like, loaded. Like, let's call Denzel. What's he doing? little did I know, that doesn't go anywhere in film. Everyone's like, yeah, no, that's no money at all. And I think how we still managed to make what I hope is still a good film, even though I guess that wasn't a lot of budget. And considering we had majority underage cast, so that eats into your budget because they all need chaperones, they can all only work a certain amount of hours a day, et cetera. So I think how we managed to overcome that was because, again, I don't have anything to compare it to, but from what I've heard, this is probably where the impact lies. Our crew was 75% female, and there was just an atmosphere of genuine care. People felt really, I hope, for the majority, felt really safe and they're able to express. And then with that kind of environment, people went above and beyond. There was always also a lot of black and brown people behind the camera as well, which for me, I think, meant that there was this kind of attention to cultural detail that we wouldn't have had, or that we would have had to, that would have been pressured on just a few people, like maybe myself, to make happen. So it meant that our production assistant, who was Somali, let us into her home to see what a Somali household felt like. And that kind of care, that kind of commitment to the work, rather than maybe having to hire a consultant, or maybe not even thinking about it. But I think people threw in things that came from themselves, that came from their heart, and that allowed us to, I hope, get over some of the obstacles of making a pretty low budget film filled with lots of people. And also just as well, I think going through the process of trying to let the film industry receive us as a collective, collaborative unit, when they're not used to that, right? They're used to saying a so-and-so's film. Like, they're used to giving authorship and ownership to one person, namely the director. So we did find there was quite a lot of pushback, and not maybe intentional or malicious, but just because people just wanted to do things how they usually do them. They wanted to write about the film in such a way that it belonged to one person. They wanted to credit only one person. They wanted one person on stage. They wanted one person answering questions. They wanted one person photographed for the film. And especially for me, who the film came from a personal desire to reflect and to honour and to thank and to adore the black and brown girls who protect family and childhoods in the way that Tracy did for me. It felt sort of strange to then, once we gave it to the world, for them to be like, okay, thanks, now bye, and then hold the film up as belonging to somebody else entirely. And I think how we overcame that, again, was Sarah, the director, who was constantly writing letters and saying, just a heads up, I won't be on stage by myself, or the film is not mine, please do not frame the film in this way. Claire Wilson, my co-writer, was constantly ready. Like, I'd be like, oh, I'd like send her an email, like, just to moan, or a text just to moan about something. And before I'd even, like, finish sending it, she's already emailed, like, the head of somebody. She's like, I've got this, don't worry. And I think that constant people backing each other and supporting each other, and that kind of sisterhood that was created, meant that we could first of all protect the young women from some of the behind the scenes politics of making film, and allow them to hopefully build friendships for life and have a real life changing experience. But then also within ourselves, we're able to constantly hold each other accountable to be the best that we should be, and to navigate this industry safely, but then also go to bat for each other when we had to, which was more often than I hope to have to do again.
When it comes to like films based on like minorities and sort of like the black community and stuff, it's quite sensationalized. and quite like the boys in the hood, like literally so many of them. For me, this was important because it really showed a female perspective of their experience growing up in the UK. And even beyond that, for me, it was almost like a sign that we need to do more for our women. I still don't feel in the film and TV industry enough is being done. But it was a very, very important film. Hence why, you know, you received awards and award nominations, which is incredible. But yeah, super important to have a film like Rocks, honestly. I think in terms of films in general, sort of the emotional impact of a film or a play happens in the moment. But what are the long-term effects that a playwright or a screenwriter dreams of making in the world? For instance, you once said in an interview that you would try and change individual people's worlds one by one. And I think you sort of touched on that earlier. But could you go into a bit more detail into what exactly that meant to you?
Realize, and I should have, because the education projects that I was doing in prison was based around the arts. So we did music and we did, you know, like plays, but I just didn't see it as art. I didn't grow up in the arts. I didn't grow up going to, that wasn't my environment, and nobody I knew did. So for me, that was education, and it was about tricking people into expression and education and personal and social development. That's kind of what I saw it its role. So when I started writing it, and it happened kind of fast, and you know, I don't want to sound ungrateful, but it kind of happened to me. So I kept my job because for me that was the important thing, and this wasn't important. This was, I felt, maybe a bit, you know what I mean, but my job felt important. And then it was Claire Wilson, my co-writer on Rocks, and my manager at Islington Gang's team. She said to me, they both said to me in separate conversations that, you know this thing that you're doing, it can be just as important as the work as your job. And my manager said, she said, I believe, I trust you that you can make this thing important too, because it was becoming quite a struggle to make a film, which is a full-time job, and go to work full-time. And I think it was little moments that started to build up and let me know what the impact of this could be. And then I started to reflect back on the impact of what the arts were in prison, which at the time I just thought was education. But now I look back and say, okay, arts. And then there is, and I used to write about the transformative power of arts. But again, I couched that in education. I didn't know what I was saying really when I said arts. I remember women would email me or DM me or come up to me in the theatre and tell me about why that was important to them and what it meant to them. And schools would message me about how it's on their syllabus now. And I loved English Lit. That was my favourite subject in school. Bit by bit, I realised actually it means something to people. And just like me being able to watch The Mighty Ducks meant that for a second or for a moment or for a month, I wanted to be an ice hockey player. Maybe that actually the things that I present could have these moments of like, of defining moments for people who experience them. I mean, it could be like, oh, for a moment you say to yourself when you watch Rocks, you're like, oh, actually, I haven't left London. That would be fun to go on a train to Hastings with my girls. It could be something as small as that, or it could be something as big as, oh, actually, maybe I want to tell my story, or maybe I want to be a teacher so I can support others to tell. Do you know what I mean? It could be anything, and I think, for me, that's the impact I wanted to have on the people that participate in the story-making process with me, but also the people who consume it. And then I think in the industry, like, the impact that I want to have is, like I said, with making Rocks, for example, it was definitely a challenging process in terms of trying to protect authorship and ownership and trying to make sure that as Black and Brown storytellers, we get to keep, our stories get to be ours. And so I want to somehow, I don't know how, but somehow make it easier. I think how I just summarize it for me is just to make it easier for the next person, just like I know the people who have gone before me in many, many ways that I will never know or understand have made it easier and have made it even possible to me to do my little bit here. So hopefully it makes it easier for the next person who doesn't have to send emails to people to ask them to remember that the stories are theirs.
Looking ahead, you're working on a new TV series for the BBC, which you've described as Big Little Lies meets Girlfriends, as well as being an amazing celebration of Nigerian British culture. So what is it and when will we see it on screen?
So that's going to be a full TV adaptation of Nicky May's book, Wahala, which is out. The book is out next year. And so that TV show, we don't have a transmission date yet because I'm doing something for BBC Three next year before that. So once, which is inspired by the book by Didier Target called Grime Kids. So once Grime Kids is up and out, which is going to be next year, then I will focus all my love and attention to making Wahala. And I'm just really looking for, I'm really looking forward to both for like so many reasons. And it's really exciting, I guess maybe sad in a way, because it shouldn't be the first time, but to be able to like just create some of the, to share these stories for not necessarily the first time, but for one of the few times we've seen them on screen by a Black woman is really exciting. I just can't wait to put in those little nuggets that are just for us, you know, what's the word, like esoteric, where it's just like, where it doesn't need to be explained and there aren't going to be any subtitles. If you know Pidgin, you know it. If you don't, sorry about it. Like just those little things, and you know, and get the soups right. I'm so tired of watching shows where people are eating the wrong food. I'm like, they don't eat that there. Like, they don't do that there. So yeah, just those. So those are the little things that I'm looking forward to. And I just really hope, like, the energy. So with Brian Kids, for example, like the amount of research that's going into getting that right. And like, you know, the name brands and the all the underground music that isn't recorded anywhere, but, you know, constantly messaging Target and saying, okay, what song was this and what did you listen to when you did this? And I just really hope that people just feel the love, these two shows that are coming up, they really feel like it's for them, like this is a real gift for them. And we have, you know, not to erase other people's work, we've had tons, but we've had work that was gifted to us before, so I'm just glad to be added to the gift of our story.
I'm really excited for this. Really, really excited. It sounds amazing.
Yeah, no, likewise. No, it sounds sick. I think a final question to sort of close, if you could give one word of advice to your 15-year-old self, what would that be?
As one word or one word?
Oh, no. Just
okay.
No, general, yeah. Just what advice?
I would tell her, so I used to always like, I don't know what was wrong with me. I think I had problems, but I used to genuinely like believe that there was a happy ever after. I just knew it in my gut. No matter what was going on, I just knew it. And I remember sometimes I would say to God, like, when's this, like, usually it happens like 3/4 of the way into the book. Does that mean 3/4 of the way into my life? What is the story? Like, when is this happening? When is it coming? So I would say to myself, just keep on, you hold on to that. Like it comes, but it comes in ways that you might not expect. It comes in the relationships you make, the people who you get to love and be loved by. It comes in the books you read and you know, the trips you get to take, and you know, even the test results you get back, the fact that you enjoy this and the food you find, and it exists. So I think I spent a lot of time waiting for it. And in hindsight now, I realise like it had started. It had always been. So I just say to myself, look around you, you're happy ever after started.
Teresa Okoko, thank you for dreaming in a nightmare. Really appreciate you coming on the podcast today. And everything just sounds incredible that you're working on. And I can't wait. So yeah, looking forward to it.
Me too.
Having me, guys. This was a lovely conversation. I really enjoyed talking to you both.
If you enjoyed being with us today and you'd like to join us again, please subscribe on your podcast player of choice. And for more information about Dreaming in a Nightmare and to find out what you can do about tackling inequality in your society, sign up to our newsletter at dreaminginanightmare.com or follow us on Instagram at dreamingxnightmare and Jeremiah's Instagram JE1BC. Dreaming in a Nightmare is a Bokomi original production inspired by the book of the same name. Your hosts today were Jeremiah Emmanuel and Kelly Okogu. The producer was me, Richard Kilgariff. Bye for now.